Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Cultural Conversations with me, your host and producer, Verona Mitchell. Join us as we bring weekly cultural topics right here to our studio. You, as our studio audience, are welcome to chime in and call the studio or join us on chat. Because, you know, at Cultural Conversations, we believe that cultural issues really do shape and impact our world. So, join us as we discuss the hottest topics and the cultural issues of our day. Stay tuned. Well, welcome to another segment of Cultural Conversations with me, your host and producer, Verona Mitchell. Tonight's guest, we have on our online studio, Dr. Nicholas Hartlip. And Dr. Hartlip, he is a repeat guest, I'm going to say, to Cultural Conversations. Before, we had Dr. Hartlip here as the author of the new book, The Model Minority, Stereotypes, Demystifying, The Model Minority Stereotype, Demystifying Success, and The Model Minority Stereotype Reader, Critical and Challenging Readings for the 21st Century. We had him on before talking about Asians as the Model Minority. Tonight, his subject is the assault on communities of color. And when we look at the violence and the actual displays that we see on social media of police brutality within communities of color and the violence that exists in communities of color, it just calls for and cries out for research and critical research that can be done and what can be gained from it, what can we learn from it, and how can we change systems or move towards reform. So Dr. Nicholas Hartlip tonight will discuss that with us and discuss his research with us as well and give us an update on what he has been doing for the last year. It's been like a year since I had him on the show, and I'm so excited to have him on today. Well, if you would like to get in on the conversation, as usual, here at Cultural Conversations, please do not hesitate in calling the show, or you can also sit back and just listen online or on your mobile devices. But if you would like to call the show, please do call 347-857-3121. Again, that number is 347-857-3121. And I'll go ahead and open up our studio line for you, our online studio line for you, so that you can engage in this cultural conversation with Dr. Nicholas Hartlip. Also, tonight, I will have the chat room open. If you would like to get into the chat room and just chat, ask the questions that you need, and I will read them here online. Also, I will be reading feeds from our social media pages, Cultural Conversation. We're going to take a one-minute break, and then we'll be right back with Dr. Nicholas Hartlip on the assault on communities of color. It's going to be an engaging show. Thank you for joining all the listening audience out there. Hope you're having a wonderful, wonderful summer and just a wonderful time here with Cultural Conversations. Thanks for taking time out of your busy schedule to hear us tonight. Thank you. Conversations with me, your host and producer, Verona Mitchell. And as I stated before, tonight's guest is Dr. Nicholas Hartlett, and he will be speaking about his new book, along with other authors, but his new work, his new research on the assault on communities of color. And it seems to be a powerful book. Critical research that we all need in our communities, and also people who are working and engaging in our communities. And so joining me now is Dr. Nicholas Hartlett. Nicholas, or Dr. Hartlett, could you give our listening audience a bit of a background about you? They're new listening audience, and some are old, but again, thank you for joining me, and if you can give our listening audience some background about you, I really would appreciate it.
Sure. Thanks for having me on, Verona. I'm an assistant professor of educational foundations at Illinois State University. Illinois State's in central Illinois, in Normal, Illinois. Beyond that, I'm a transracial adoptee. So I was born in Korea and adopted by two white American parents. And my identity as a transracial adoptee has been very salient in my life. So studying race is only natural for me. The book, The Assaults on Communities of Color, Exploring the Realities of Race-Based Violence, really came from discussions I had with the first primary editor, Kenny Bonner. He's a professor and friend at LSU, Louisiana State University. And we were discussing, I had written with him about the murder of Trayvon Martin, which, to remind listeners that, you know, that was February of 2012. And we were talking about how, you know, his book had been published, but you know, it was outdated already because there were so many more murders of African-American males, females, and it was just really horrible because Mike Brown was murdered. And we had this discussion. We said, you know what, we need to write a book to honor Mike Brown. And that's essentially the, you know, that's all it took, that conversation. And then we wrote and even getting the contract was kind of difficult because, you know, the publisher was like, you know, is that going to be a book that will sell? Is it important? And not only is it important, clearly it is. We wanted a book to be one that wasn't overly scholarly in the sense that we didn't want citations, because anyone that's listening, you know, and has read kind of a collegiate level book, they're really dense and they use a lot of citations. And so we wanted to approach this book in a manner that was very accessible and was very affective when you read it, very visceral. And so trying to sell that to the publisher, as well as a variety of other elements proved challenging, but in the end, you know, they did give us a contract. And when you read that book, you'll notice, too, many prolific scholars contributed. So if they listen to this airing, I'd like to thank them all. I know all the editors would like to thank them for contributing and sharing their stories, essentially.
Right. I just want to acknowledge that you are not the sole author of, you know, Assault on Communities of Color, but they have, how many other authors are there on this?
So Dr. Varner and I, as well as we had contributing editors, Lori Martin, Cleveland Hayes, Roland Mitchell, and Shonda Allen Mitchell. So it was a group project, certainly. And it was better for it.
And I just want to make sure I'm saying the correct title to the book so that our listening audience, you can go out and get it on Amazon. I saw it a couple of days ago on Amazon. So it's The Assault on Communities of Color. And then there's another title to that, Nicholas. I'm pretty sure you're going to give us more information about that. But it is out on Amazon right now. Now, this book, although you wrote it and you are academics, all academics, and the first thing is to write in that academic vein, in the research vein, but you also wrote this so that the everyday layperson or people who are engaging in communities of color can find themselves within the pages of this book or kind of identify what's going on in communities of color. But just to break it down for our listening audience, what are we witnessing in the realm of policing of communities of color, and why are we seeing the acts of violence that we're seeing? You know, a lot of people say it's social media. It's been going on, but now social media can get information to us more rapidly. What are we seeing as a researcher in? What are we seeing in communities of color?
Absolutely, Verona. I think definitely it's spot on. The analysis, right, shared by folks on social media saying, look, this has been going on for a long time, and only now with smartphones are we capturing it and disseminating it. Another consideration I think that's important to say is, we're kind of at the height of incarcerating folks of color in terms of the new Jim Crow, that, you know, so many black and brown people find themselves locked up out of sight, that the reality is, you know, it's very much underreported. You know, people say, oh, it's only the times when a white police officer does something to a minority that social media shares it. That's not necessarily true. Many of my colleagues, people who edited this book, would be very enraged if a white person was treated in such a manner, right? In terms of a rough ride, right? Like Freddie Gray in the back of a paddy wagon, you know, intentionally roughed up, as they call, you know, a rough ride. No one really is in support of that, no matter what the race. But what's very important to point out is that people of color in the United States are becoming so upset because of not being heard, not being seen. And you know, folks have shared that. You know, when people came to Baltimore and were, you know, supposedly reporting on the riots, you know, young folk were saying, where were you when, you know, when unemployment is high? Where were you, you know, when all of these problems were occurring? You just came now when you're seeing us doing this behavior because, right, it feeds this myth, right? And the myth is that they're, you know, deviants on the street.
Go ahead, finish your thought.
So in terms of why we're seeing police brutality, because we have smart technology, certainly, but this stuff has been going on for a long time, and it repeats. I mean, even Trayvon, Michael Brown, Eric Garner, even before them, Oscar Grant, and long before them,
right.
We have documented cases. Emmett Till. I mean, the list goes on. How many more African American and minorities need to be killed? Extrajudicial murders. So, as a critical race theorist, this is normal behavior on America. You know, systemic behavior, and I don't think it's going away because it's so much part of our society.
It is, you know, thank you for really breaking down the theory and what we're seeing on the ground, a practical aspect of this violence that we're seeing with people who are there to police and control and monitor. And it often led me to my experiences growing up in New Orleans, Louisiana, where we had a lot of internal violence in our community, but we had a community. So we knew each other, people knew each other, and they had other external factors that would come into the community. And then you had the policing of the community. And I remember the policing of the community not knowing that they were there to publicly serve the members of the community. I thought they were there to be the violent, you know, inflictors, to be the oppressors of the community. That's my engagement as a very young child that I saw operating within the community framework. And this was not only white police officers, these were black police officers, both white and black police officers operating in that vein within communities and within the community of color in New Orleans. Whether it was a fight or something as small as an argument, it seems as though when they got to the community, when the police got to the community, they were already fed up and frustrated from having to come to that particular community. It wasn't a pleasant thing for them to come. And they would inflict violence or, you know, talk disrespectful to everyone, regardless of if you were a female, if you were a male, if you were an elder, if you were a senior, regardless if you were a child, they would use language that was disrespectful. And nobody, I mean, you can make a follow report, but it's more than likely that nothing would get done. Now we're at the point where we see social media taking a role and you're capturing this on you know, live and on the internet. And so it's very, this phenomenon, and you don't know when it will end. But one of my questions for you as researching this in the community, when did we, communities of color, become the communities that you must police and patrol, and the dominant white communities became the communities where you serve? You don't police and patrol, you serve. So if my car breaks down in a community of color, or if I have a taillight out, a policeman will not stop me and say, "Hey, miss, I just want to let you know that your taillight is out. You may want to get that fixed." And I'm not going to shake his hand and say, "Thank you, officer." If go to my suburban community, when a police stop me, it's to serve and help me, not to interrogate me. So I want to know from someone who's researching, why is that?
Well that's a great question. That's a great question. A variety of reasons. First off, we should be reminded, you know, the Black Panthers in the 60s, they started arming themselves visibly, and they started policing the police, right? Because they knew what was going down. Your question in, you know, the 21st century is for a variety of reasons, but one is for containment. and it's to maintain segregation. So when you think about redlining, gentrification, gerrymandering, and, you know, you have segregated spaces. So you have the west sides, you have the east sides, depending on what city, right, you live in. And those spaces are segregated. And so the police, right, like you mentioned, depending on where you find yourself. So a person of color in a segregated white space, he will be profiled. You know, why are you driving here? For a variety of reasons. You might have a dumpy car, and then that they peg you for it. Or you might be driving in a very nice car, and then they'll peg you for that, because clearly the police will believe, you know, you stole the car. Whatever reason it is, it's racist. Racial profiling is real. And so your question about why in some communities it's serve and protect and the others it's not is precisely because wealthier areas, the police protect those spaces because of property values, right, insurance and what have you, and then they leave other ghettoized, minoritized spaces alone. And, I mean, it's real that there are certain locations in the U.S. where the police really don't go for, you know, and that's problematic. You're right. They should be serving and protecting. But people of color at many times don't get that feeling and don't get that reality or that experience in their actions.
And, you know, I think we're kind of preaching to each other and preaching to the choir. And a lot of times I'll make a joke when I'm driving and say, you know, if I see a police officer, he's supposed to come over and say, hi, how are you? Is everything fine? And usually the person in my car will just put up a smirk on their face and say, yeah, really, that you're wishing me. But, you know, when did we start training? And now we're looking at, you know, reform in the areas of a lot of police departments and the way that we do policing, that every, you know, we should reform it where it's flat, that it's a baseline and every community, they're treated with respect. But when did we, historically now, when and who teaches our police force how to treat a certain community? Because you just don't know, you just don't, you know, come out of your mother's womb saying, I'm going to treat this community this way, but this community I'm going to treat that way. So I wonder if it's something in the academy that they're learning, because this phenomenon is, you know, across the United States, it's nationwide. And I need to be enlightened on why do I see this phenomenon happening nationwide. It's not just concentrated in one area. So could you enlighten me on that?
Absolutely. Sure. So in some of the sections in the book address things like the mythical post-racial America or minority and minoritized communities, black male experience. You know, when I'm driving and I'm a law-abiding citizen and I drive by a police officer, I immediately feel fear. And you know, I could be driving the speed limit, and I immediately get tensed up and fearful. And the reason I think I get fearful, I'm not sure why other people get fearful, is the amount of power police officers have. Right, they can pull you over, and if you don't know your rights, they can make you feel very vulnerable, even though you're a law-abiding citizen. And they do that for a variety of reasons, but I think the compliance is very much right. You do what the police officer says. If you don't, you're gonna have problems and experience problems. I think the police academy, you know, wants that. They want citizens to comply immediately, instantaneously to, you know, a command. Get down, put your hands behind your back, don't move, right? For a variety of reasons. the problem I have is I don't think it's in the academy that this behavior is much. I think it's as people are growing up, they're conditioned in America that black lives are expendable, that they don't have to treat, and it's very much based on inferiority, right? You hear it. You hear the boys who have been murdered. He was attacking me like an animal. He was shot and he just continued to come at me. That is rooted somewhere beyond something trained in the academy. To me, that is based in our history, right? Where, slaves wore property, and that chattel slavery was legalized. You could own a man, right? And so for us to erase that, I mean, studies have found police officers in an implicit bias. They're more apt to pull the trigger when a suspect is a black or brown. They're more apt to, treat apprehended criminals differently, depend on their color of their skin. And so I think that that's not a product of police training per se. Certainly people have talked about body cameras, that if the police officers are aware of being taped, they will treat people more kindly. Maybe not. Hear those cases where the cops will erase the tapes or try to dispose of them, and so we have a lot of problems in the justice system. Ironically, it's called the justice system. Even jurors, we have incredible amounts of implicit bias at play. Supposedly you get a jury of your peers, right? But that's not often the case in these cases.
You're giving such deep conversation and such deep research. I want others to get in on this conversation. Nicholas, this is very important, and I can see the next steps to your work is being, how do you present this maybe to Congress, or how do you present this to the White House in a formal kind of way that looks at reform in communities of color? No, I'm not going to say reform in communities of color. I'm going to say reform in how law enforcement engages in communities of color. And when we get back, we're going to take a break, but when we get back, we're going to talk about what are some of the next steps, and then what are some of the nuances of the book, The Assault on Communities of Color, Exploring the Realities of Race-Based Violence by Dr. Nicholas Hartnett. And so the look out for the next segment that we're going to start talking about, what are some of the solutions? We'll be right back with Cultural Conversations. Joining us here at Cultural Conversations. This is your host and producer, Verona Mitchell. Tonight we are having a cultural conversation with Dr. Nicholas Hartnett. He is the author of The Assault on Communities of Color, Exploring the Realities of Race-Based Violence in Our Communities of Color, that is. And just to give you a little background about Dr. Hartnett, he is an assistant professor of education foundations, and he's wrote some other books as well. He wrote some Model Minority Stereotype, Demystifying Success in 2013. He wrote the Model Minority Stereotype Reader, Critical and Challenging Readings for the 21st Century. And so his whole background study is the Model Minority and now focusing on communities of color here in the United States where we have such violence, not internally and, of course, from external factors, one being noted law enforcement and how they engage with communities of color. And so if you would like to get in on this cultural conversation, please, you can call the online studio. That number is 347-857-3121. Again, our online studio number is 347-857-3121. We've also opened the chat room in case you want to engage and ask any questions that you may want to ask, and I can go ahead and give that to our special guest tonight. You know, when you think about all of the things that have happened since the Trayvon Martin shooting and the things that we see on social media and via people capturing these images through their cell phones, in some way we got to be thankful of technology. I know people, you know, they complain about technology. Technology is moving so fast and the different things that we see on social media. I'm going to say 75% of it is more personal and joking and silliness than anything. But then there's the critical piece that we do see coming across on maybe Twitter feeds or Facebook feeds that make you stop and think. And these researchers, I'm glad that they took the time to write this very important book and text that anyone can pick up. It's actually on Amazon right now. And Dr. Hartlett, he's going to give us more information about what's contained in the pages of those books. But I think even if you don't reside in a community of color, it would be great to have such a text in your arsenal, in your library, and really understand people that may not be like you or may not come from the same background, but we're all living this world together, and we fear what we don't understand, and this brings us more to an understanding of those communities and in ourselves. And so you got to go out and get the book. That's my plug for the book. Again, if you would like to call and join in on this cultural conversation with Dr. Hartlett, please do call our online studio. You're welcome to call in and chime in. We're at 347-857-3121. Again, we're at 347-857-3121. Dr. Hartlett, you are back on with Cultural Conversations. Now, let me ask you just one question. And I know you talked about the violence and talked about a little about the historical path that we took or that happened where they looked at communities of color and decided that you have to control that community, you have to contain it, you have to segregate it. So how do we reform this idea or this, I want to say almost it's a theology, when I look at the police officers, I look at them and I kind of pity them and have compassion. I said, they don't even know what they're doing and why they're doing what they do. And how can we educate and protect the community from such acts, but also educate and reform on the other side?
Yeah, that's the million-dollar question, Verona. I think everyone is attempting their own strategy and attempting to do that work. My thought is education, right? In informing folks who then there's a multiplier effect, right? So when I have 60 students in a semester, if something resonates in my course and they tell four or five people, there I get close to 250 to 300 people. So education certainly has to has to be part of the strategy. It needs to be a multi-pronged approach from my perspective. I think so much of the myth, again, in like post-racial America, is because it is so sexy. We can it seems almost logical, like, right, that police officers want to protect and serve everyone, right, and they don't have bias. But I think it's important to see the connections. So, for instance, the assaults on communities of color and exploring the realities of race-based violence. Race-based violence doesn't have to be end in death, per se. It can be education, for instance. In the U.S., we have a very much race-based education system, and that can be violent to students of color, right? Mm-hmm. Understanding how, if you live in a segregated part of town, you will attend a segregated school, and if you live in a property wealthy section of town, you're going to be going to a very well-funded school. And so I think we need to draw these connections of how education, the justice system are interlocked. Think of, for instance, the school-to-prison pipeline. Understanding, I mentioned, we're at the height of incarcerating Black and brown people in this country, and they're out of sight. Understanding that there's a connection here. If we don't school students, they end up in prison. And if they end up in prison, it's more costly for society, but then also that there are people that profit from the prison industrial complex. Understanding how all of these big industries are tied and who profits from the status quo. So the assault on communities of color, while we talk a lot about the murders, certainly those are very disconcerting and troubling, we also have to understand and recognize that there are a lot of societal problems that manifest themselves, and they are tied to race. Health, the medical field, social determinants of health, low birth weight, housing, schooling. So those are, I think, entry points. And like I mentioned, a lot of people are doing this great work, this important work. I don't know if there's a silver bullet per se, but again, that's the million-dollar question. A lot of people want these problems to continue. So when we think about reform, for instance, a lot of people benefit from this notion that we have a crisis, right, and that we need to reform it. The reformers make a lot of money off of this discourse. But the system, as my friend and colleague Kenny says, Dr. Varner, the system is broken, and it's not really broken because it's working the way it was designed to. It really was. If listeners haven't read any about Willie Lynch, that's the man we get the term from, lynching. And he has a powerful letter in which he writes to his comrades who mostly write own slaves. And he talks about how to break a man's soul, really, and spirit. Right, how you beat him in front of his mother, right, or wife, and that psychological trauma, I see that occurring modern day forms of lynching, as my other colleague Dr. Cleveland Hayes talks about. So the assaults on communities of color can be physical, psychological, legal, educational, and they're continuing at an unprecedented rate.
Mm-hmm. I also see, and it's ironic that you bring up the Willie Lynch letter. Mm-hmm. It's digging way in race theory, and what you can see, the remnants or the impact of what was listed in that letter and how to break an African or slave, mm-hmm. African, enslaved African, mm-hmm. and how to how this particular, I'm going to say subscription, if you subscribe to this treatment, it will last for 400 years or over 400 years. And it's ironic that you're bringing that up, because when I look at the reform that maybe needs to take place, we need to start at the beginning on how did we get to this moment. And I know we've talked about, you know, in this cultural conversation, we've talked about, you know, some historical paths, but we can cite the historic, but actually how are we continuing this miseducation, and how do we turn that around in the reform system? I'm gonna let you get a, we're gonna take a break, think about that, and give us some chapters in that book. I looked it up online, and they have some of your book is already out there. The chapters are already out there for people to see. But I would like to kind of get your feel on some of the chapters and how we can educate ourselves when we put our hands on that book and get more information about the assault on communities of color. We'll be right back with Cultural Conversations. Listening to Cultural Conversations here with your host and producer, Verona Mitchell. Tonight's Cultural Conversation, we've centered on the violence that we see in communities of color internally and externally from factors such as law enforcement. We have Dr. Nicholas Hartnett, who's written a wonderful book along with other authors and researchers. The Assault, the book The Assault on Communities of Color, Exploring the Realities of Race-Based Violence. And so we're going to dig a little bit into the book for a little while and have Dr. Hartnett talk about the different chapters in the book and talk about different solutions that we can employ in communities of color. So Dr. Hartnett, you're back on with Cultural Conversations. What are some of the chapters in the book that we can center and focus on in looking at solutions to the problems that we're seeing with law enforcement and engagement in communities of color?
Sure. So for instance, the the section on post-racial America, there are a lot of powerful chapters. One in particular, for instance, The Opposite of a Great Lie, Racism, Capitalism, and Education Policy, Knowing Our History, talking about white supremacy, how white supremacy began, and then how it continues. I'm thinking of Paul Gorski's chapter. Paul is a white man, professor at George Mason University. And Ferguson and the Violence of It's All About Me, White Liberalism. I know Paul pretty well. What resonated to me about his chapters is his sensitivity and understanding that even though he's an anti-racist white ally, how he always has to monitor, his behavior, his allegiance, his actions. I think of chapters like We Can't Breathe, The Impacts of Police Brutality on Women of Color by Subini Anonima. Her chapter is very powerful because the narrative really is that black boys are murdered at disproportional rates, right? Her chapter really centers how police brutality impacts women of color, right, who have to witness the maltreatment and murder of perhaps their brother or, significant other family members, right? But then also how actually the police state, the carceral state, maltreats women of color. I'm thinking of Donna Ford, African-American professor at Vanderbilt, her chapter talking about the black male experience in the U.S. Her chapter, Save Our Black Males, subtitled, I Should Not Have to Celebrate That My Son Lived to See the Age of 35, right? I'm 31 years of age, and her chapter is very powerful because it's personal, which I'm very, I'm very honored she feel that she could share that testimony. But really critiquing, right, that the fact that her son is still alive is not something she should have to celebrate, right? Because the reality is, right, that her son as a black man is at risk of being killed by the hands of the people who supposedly are supposed to protect him. I'm trying to look right more. Shirley Steinberg's chapter recounting her experiences growing up in Southern California. Very, very powerful. I remember, sharing with her that my hair was on fire, literally, when I read that. So what I'd like to share, I guess, is understanding when we're talking about the assault on communities of color, we're not just saying white people do this, right? Just as you mentioned, white supremacy, we have minority police officers who perpetuate white supremacy, intentionally or unintentionally. So we have to understand that, there are contributors to the book who are white, who are anti-racist, and their contributions are very important, as well as the contributions of the people of color, Latino, Latina, we have Asian, African-American. And it's important to understand, and I tell my students, because I'm using the book this summer in my summer courses, that, and I told another interviewer this, the book is the book in the sense that, it shares a lot of trauma and a pain, and that in sharing that pain, there's something productive in sharing that pain. And so when you read that, the fact that these are real life experiences, I think we need to really be sensitive to that. And to me, I'm thinking of Martin Luther King a lot, because when he didn't condemn rioting, right? Because he talks about a riot as the language of the unheard. in many respects, these narratives are so painful, but we're given a space to share and to be heard. The fact that people are reading this book, their voices are being heard. And I think there's some power behind that. And so I just want to reiterate how honored all of the editors were, the fact that people would put pen to paper to share their realities of race-based violence.
You know, and I think thank you, Nicholas, for actually sharing their lived experiences. And I think that's important as we look and hear the voices of the community, that we respect people's lived experiences. And although it may be difficult to acknowledge those, it may be difficult to hear those, I think that one of the key ways that we get to having a dialogue is that we need to be willing to hear those difficult conversations and have those difficult conversations. We're not saying that all law enforcement is evil and is fallen from the pit of hell. That's not what we're saying.
Absolutely.
But there's work that needs to be done. And we're not automatically saying that it's only, you know, the Black community. I'm African American, so I can speak from the African American experiences that I've had in African American communities. Can't speak to all of them, but I can speak to the ones that I witnessed. But I also, when I moved to Minnesota, I moved into a fairly Hmong community here in Minnesota, and I could speak to the lived experiences that I had there, seeing police officers and police enforcement crackdown there. And so there's a lot of communities of color that can share their experiences, regardless of your African American, Latino, Hmong, or what have you. We can share those experiences and lived experiences. It may not be in an elaborate academic book such as Assault on Communities of Color, but it would be good to get a panel of just everyday community people sharing those experiences. And so I think your book kind of starts out having that deep critical conversation, but it's also, from what you're telling me, it's built on the lived experiences of those researchers and what they witness in their own communities or communities that they frequent. Nicholas,
absolutely.
Where can we get your book? I mean, as we round out our hour here, can't believe it's been an hour, where could one pick up your book or continue a conversation with you? If you have a page or a website?
Absolutely. They can find information on my website, nicholashartlip.com, NICHOLAS. HARTLEP.com. That's all one word. They can certainly find it on Amazon. Roman and Littlefield is the publisher, so they can find it on their website, Roman, ROWMAN.com. If they even just Google it, which I did, it popped right up, the Assault on Communities of Color. But they definitely, I would encourage any listener to go check it out. If not, ask your local library to buy it, you know, and that way the community can have a copy or what have you. It's very accessible. Not, you know, it's not an overly academic book in the sense there aren't citations. And it's very important. I want to say, Verona, I really appreciate you having me on too, because in many ways you're allowing my voice and the voices of others to be heard. And again, when we think about why are, you know, we're having these issues, I mean, I just read, Verona, this was dated June 5th, 2015. Unemployment rate for African Americans over 10%, nearly twice the national average, which is 5.5, and more than double the rate for whites last month. We have a lot of economic strife. We have a lot of racial strife, and they're all interconnected. They're all interconnected.
Right.
So we need to consider those things.
And, you know, I agree that we, you know, these issues are all interconnected. We can't, you know, kind of bury ourselves and run to the suburbs, and I don't mean, you know, or gentrify our community where we're not letting other people in. It's, we need to diversify and really understand other people in order to live among them. Or we can continue as we are doing now, kind of even subliminally policing certain communities and then letting other communities roam free and grow. And so I think that's the biggest kind of going back to the root of the issue. It would be that root, that how do you let one community grow and thrive? And I see it here. I live in a suburb, but I used to live right in the hood, and I can see the vast differences of engagement and the welcoming attitude and the welcoming spirit among law enforcement, as opposed to going into the inner city and seeing the vast difference. And, you know, yes, every community has issues. Even suburbs have issues. Inner city has issues. Everyone should be treated humanely. And I think that's getting back to that kind of critical race theory in the history of racism here in the United States. Nicholas, any lasting words for our listening room from you as we end our hour?
No, I would just encourage folks to consider, you know, ordering a copy of the book to stay connected, you know, to what's going on. Certainly social media helps us do that. I know the Rachel case, hashtag Rachel, with the white girl supposedly who is in the media now. Race is at play, you know, as a critical race theory, race is always present. So just encourage folks to stay connected and talk about these issues.
Well, thank you for joining me tonight on Culture Conversation, Dr. Hartland. I look forward to having you at another time for another critical research that you will be doing and exploring social science research. So I've been excited to have you tonight. You're always a pleasurable guest. And thank you for imparting your knowledge to our community.
Thanks, Rona. I was honored to be on your show.
Well, thank you for here at my cultural conversations. I look forward to seeing and experiencing our listening audience next week as we bring another good topic to the forefront. Thank you for joining me tonight. This is Verona Mitchell, and thank you for joining me on Cultural Conversations. At Cultural Conversations, we're bringing weekly cultural issues and topics to our online studio. Join me next week as we bring more of Cultural Conversations. Thank you for joining me. See you next week. Thank you.